BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Military specialists go into Libya and NATO drones rain terror from the skies now. China and Russia say the mission is creeping way beyond the no-fly zone. But does this and the use of radioactive uranium tank buster shells constitute war crimes? And how are Gaddafi's forces or the rebels supposed to surrender to a drone? We hear from Chris Cole of Drone Watch UK and examine shocking revelations about NATO's hidden agenda. Plus, a Good Friday situation report from the Holy Land on tensions being stoked up by the religious fanatics of 2011 from the Haifa-born son of a 1940s civil servant in British-controlled Palestine. But first, US investment bank Goldman Sachs profits are up this week, way above expectations, but the dollar is doomed. Martin Summers will explain the contradiction. And first of all, Martin, Standard & Poor's, the doom side of this little equation, Standard & Poor's have this week brought down the US economy to a negative credit rating. What does this mean?
Well, they haven't done that yet. They're threatening to do it. They haven't actually downgraded them as such.
The outlook has been lowered to negative.
Yes, the outlook, yeah. So they're saying that there's a downside risk, basically. I think Standard & Poor's and the credit ratings agencies are really up, need to be questioned. I mean, obviously, they rated all of this junk as AAA, so why anybody takes any notice of them, I really don't know. But on the other hand, the contradictions in what's happening are becoming increasingly clear. As governments cut, the ratings agencies actually downgrade their credit rating. This should be obvious to George Osborne. He is basically threatening Britain's credit rating by his policy, but he's ideological and not pragmatic, and he's going to go his head's going to go through the windscreen.
Well, it's the same time as S&P are lowering the forecasts of the US economy. Goldman Sachs, a big US based investment bank, is smashing the forecast with $2.7 billion profits just in its first quarter. So how come one of the biggest investment banks in the US is able to do incredibly well whilst the US economy is hitting the buzzers?
It's because all the resources are being drained out of the US economy to give to Goldman Sachs and their like. This is what's crushing the economy. The financial sector has become entirely parasitic. It performs no useful function. It's basically looting and theft, and a lot of it is based on fraud. Goldman Sachs, for example, was selling collateralized debt obligations out of the front of the shop, which they were betting against as on the downside at the back of the shop, and they were even designing the CDOs to fail so that they could bet against them in basically defrauding investors. Not only have they not been punished, they've been rewarded with a bailout, and they're now pocketing the bailout money. Meanwhile, schools, hospitals, railways, roads, infrastructure crumbles, and the wars rage out of control. It's a pretty depressing scene.
It's rather annoying that the economy can do really badly while investment banks are doing incredibly well.
Well, that's because we've allowed investment banks to rule the roost, and that's what the problem is. We need to break their back.
But meantime, and this is a story actually from way back in December last year, a sophisticated con man who created fake identities to defraud banks of £650,000 was jailed for 8 years at Bristol Crown Court. This is someone called Martin Foster, also known as Gordon Alastair Darling Brown, he changed his name, committed these scams on a business-like scale with an accomplice from an office at his rented house in Chipping Sodbury. After conjuring false identities, he obtained credit cards on their behalf half, and he lived the high life, treating himself to prestige cars, designer watches, meals at gourmet restaurants and hotel stays in the south of France. At one time, he was even driving around in a gold Bentley with a registration number FIJ2, the court heard. So how does this kind of crime, and this guy has gone down for several years, whilst you're chatting, I'll just check how many years he's now been jailed for, compare to the sort of fraud that's been going on at places like Goldman Sachs?
Well, 650,000 is chicken feed. You know, an investment banker or hedge fund trader wouldn't get out of bread in the morning for that. That's what they expect to get as for you know, a day's work.
Well, his lawyer has said frauds have been directed at banks and not at individuals. It was the creation of false identities. It was just banks that may mitigate the overall criminality involved. That was what his lawyer said.
Well, I mean, if you're stealing from banks, banks then have to recoup the money from the other depositors, so it's still theft. But frankly, this is small beer compared to the real fraud at the top. There is clear evidence that the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States should have moved against some of these people, but they haven't. During the savings and loans scandal of the 1980s, which was the Reagan-era financial shenanigans collapse, 1,500 executives were sent to prison. And Paul Krugman, I think it was, who's a US economist, or Joe Stiglitz, one of the other of them was saying that you know, we need to send some investment bankers to some serious hard prisons, and then and only then will they not engage in fraudulent
activity.
Well, what
about Bernie Madoff? Wasn't he one of the people?
The problem with Bernie Madoff is he stole from other rich people, which is why they all got mad at him. The fact is that Goldman Sachs are stealing from the poor, and they're getting away with it.
On the same topic, because Goldman Sachs are very much part of the Bilderberg conferences, we've heard also that Bilderberg is going to be meeting in Switzerland this year. This is from James P. Tucker Jr., American Free Press. The shadowy group, he says, known as the Bilderberg, will be gathering this year for its annual meeting at the resort city of St. Moritz in southeast Switzerland from June the 9th to the 12th, but they will have a lot of company. St. Moritz is a short distance from Davos, the site of the regular high-priced meeting of thousands of bankers, political leaders and other notables called the World Economic Forum. But unlike at Davos, where the press is welcome, Bilderberg still tries to maintain absolute secrecy. Now, I've been following the Bilderberg for years, Martin. You know exactly who they are. Is this actually, do you think, going to be an interesting meeting this year?
Well, it will be because of the world economic crisis and all the wars.
But the eyes and the ears in the public are completely denied.
Well, as you say, the problem with these meetings is that they are secret. And also, I think the real problem is elected politicians attending them. If the bankers want to get together and have a confab, who can stop them? But elected politicians are supposed to be answerable to the people who vote for them. And they, if they're going to go to these meetings, have to report back to the people who voted for them. And if it's all secret, they can't.
But the thing is also that the editors, two editors from The Economist magazine, editors from political newspapers around Europe, plus Marcus Agius, who's a BBC governor or trustee now they have, including Rupert Murdoch's, also his chief executive, go along to these meetings. But not a word is breathed about it anywhere except now we seem to have reports quite regularly in The Guardian about it from Charlie Skelton.
Yeah, but I mean, let's put it this way. If Bilderberg didn't exist, they would invent something else to fill its place. Adam Smith pointed out years ago that business people very rarely get together, even on social occasions, without some conspiracy against the public being cooked up. What I question is what is being discussed at these meetings, because we know that many of these people are criminals, fraudsters, war criminals, torturers. Look at all the people in the Middle East that will know that the Middle East doesn't get invited to Bilderberg. You know, it's Anglo-American.
It's the NATO countries.
It's Anglo-American stuff.
The NATO countries. And you know, Henry Kissinger's a big figure in all this. Yes.
He's calling for a ground invasion of Libya, I read on the internet earlier. So that's the sort of thing he'll be pushing at Bilderberg.
And the weird thing is that we have lots of prime ministers and presidents, for example, Clinton and Tony Blair.
I think that's the problem. Those people should not be going to private confabs with the financial elite where they don't talk about what they're doing to their electorates. Basically, elected politicians should be barred from going to Bilderberg.
Okay, so let's have a little bit of music now, and after that we'll discuss Libya. This is from Nana Cherry.
Scratching and give me a beat. Ouch! Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce the hi-hat. Go on.
That's good. Now the tambourine. Right now. Noise, manhandling toys. That's the girls on the block with the nasty curls, wearing padded bras, sucking beer through straws, dropping down their drawers. Where did you get yours?
Gigolo,
huh?
Sucker, gigolo. Gigolo,
huh? Sucker.
Gigolo. Who's looking good today? Who's looking good in every way? No style, gee. You better watch, don't mess with me.
That was Buffalo Stance by Nena Cherry from 1989, a song of my misspent youth. Nena being the daughter of the jazz trumpeter Don Cherry.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, US and British Predator drones are flying above the Libyan skies as of today, and this is a military tactic that's caused havoc in Pakistan. Earlier this month, the Human Rights Commission in Pakistan, their annual report, said that US drones killed nearly 1,000 Pakistani civilians in 2010, which does not do a lot for winning hearts and minds, rather like the report earlier about Afghanistan. The report criticised the Pakistani government too for failing to protect citizens, especially religious minorities. It said the biggest terrorist incident took place in Lahore, at a place of worship, a religious minority. The attack left 99 members of the Ahmadi sect dead. Well, drones are in the crosshairs for a change here, and last week I caught up with Chris Cole of Drone Watch UK, who was giving a presentation on the subject here in Bristol.
My name's Chris Cole. I'm a peace campaigner, a long-time peace campaigner, and I've come here tonight to share some information, to have some discussion and questions about drone wars, the idea of remote wars, which drones are very much part of, that you can stay at home, stay behind in your comfortable, secure city. People can stay at home and launch attacks from distances of several 8,000 miles. And I think that that's very worrying, morally, ethically and legally, that we can kill at such great distances. Britain's drones are in Afghanistan, and we think also Iraq, maybe Yemen, we're not quite sure. One of the issues about all this is the amount of secrecy that's surrounding the whole issue. But we know that Britain's are using armed Reaper drones in Afghanistan. They have 4 Reaper drones that we know of definitely there.
And what armaments are on these drones? Because they're not just cameras, are they?
No. They're Hellfire missiles and 500-pound, what they call laser-guided bombs. We know that they've used what they call a Hellfire missile. There is a variety of that missile, which is a thermobaric version, which is a fuel-air explosive. But again, they're refusing to say whether they're using the fuel-air explosive from drones. There are particular concerns about this weapon. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and other human rights organisations say that it's a particular variety that would cause severe damage to many people way beyond the actual area of impact.
I've seen pictures of these being controlled, and it looks like this, like the Xbox controller, like almost like a video game.
Yeah. Philip Alston, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killing, he talks about the PlayStation mentality. Young men who come straight out of university or straight from college, or not even from the street, are being brought into the military specifically for their kind of game playing skills, if you like. We're beginning to see the military recruiting now using Xboxes and game boxes to draw young people in. And it's ironic, that's probably not the right word, but that those are the kind of skills that are being needed now, the ability to take vast amounts of information in very quickly, and the screens are very much like game screens, video screens. And the worry is that people, rather than seeing flesh and blood, they're seeing kind of mere pixels on the screen, and that we are very concerned about, that actually lowers the threshold in terms of when attacks will be launched.
There is also a doubt over whether this is legal, because you have actually no chance to surrender to a drone.
That's right. Well, there are many legal issues about this. So this has kind of given rise to the whole area of targeted killings, assassinations, where the US military, and we believe the UK military, but again, they're being very reticent, are engaged in targeted killing, assassinations. And huge amounts of evidence are being lost in this. When you blow up a house or a compound, huge amounts of evidence that could link you, telephones, physical records, are being lost. So the kind of whole era of investigation is being lost. But certainly, of course, in terms of whether one is allowed under international law to kill people who aren't directly engaged in combat, particularly in Pakistan, where there is no war has been declared, it's very doubtful whether that is legal.
Whereabouts can people go to find out more about drones?
A good place would be the website that I kind of maintain. It's called Drone Wars UK. It's at dronewars.wordpress.com.
Oh, that's peace activist Chris Cole there. Now, Martin Summers is joining me in the studio, our old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, what is the implication, do you think, of the announcement last night that these are now being used in Libya? The first mission apparently was cancelled due to bad weather, but they're up in the skies today and searching for targets.
Well, I mean, it's just another barbaric weapon that we're chucking at the poor brown people, isn't it? What really angers me about all of this is how blasé people are about bringing war to other people's countries. And if, for example, if I was a Bahraini young person, I might think, as the Libyan rebels have thought, I've got a government here that's taken my brother and tortured him to death. They're backed by the British government. Perhaps I should go to Britain and kill some politicians or some soldiers. And if I was a Bahraini, I might start thinking like that, mightn't I? People have got to realise, if you go to somebody else's country and start a war, they may come and start a war with you.
Actually,
and you won't like it.
Well, we didn't start the war, did we, in Libya? It was started by the rebels, and we're just there backing
them. Well, all right, but we'll come to Libya in a minute. But, I mean, Bahrain...
That is Libya we're talking about. Yeah. The drones have just last night been brought into Libya.
Okay. Well, I mean, I presume we're going to talk about DU in a minute as well. I mean, drones are obviously another way of making warfare more clinical, less real. But the reality, of course, of warfare is that Taliban, using old-fashioned handheld weaponry and improvised explosive devices, are taking NATO to pieces, despite all their high-tech kit. Because modern warfare isn't won by high-tech, it's won by motivated guerrilla fighters who know what they're doing. And that's not Libyan rebels, that's the Taliban. The Taliban, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, there are a few outfits around the planet that really know what modern warfare looks like. And I'm afraid it's the British and the Americans are way behind the curve.
But Taliban and guerrillas and Gaddafi's forces can't do a lot about these drones, can they? Maybe that's why they're using them.
Yeah, but air power is pretty useless. I mean, during the air attack on Serbia during the Kosovo war, the Americans claimed that they'd blown up hundreds of Serbian tanks. It transpired at the end that they'd managed to knock out one because the Serbs had hidden all their tanks and created lots of false tanks for them to blow up. Air power, in fact, is pretty useless in modern warfare, especially if you've got people hiding inside a civilian population. It's just virtually useless. You can kill a lot of civilians, and that's what they're doing, but all that does is recruit people to fight for the rebels, whoever they may be.
Now, NATO is potentially committing further war crimes with the use of depleted uranium, armour-piercing shells. DU is a waste product of the uranium enrichment. It's uranium-238 waste after the U-235 has been separated from it to make nuclear fuel rods for reactors. It's very expensive to dispose of depleted uranium, but rather than pay for that, the military have found it can be made into shells and fired at an enemy. But it leaves a toxic radioactive legacy all around the blown-up tank, and also for literally thousands of future generations, wherever it's used. But DU is also produced at Sellafield when spent fuel rods from power stations are reprocessed. This DU is much more radioactive and dangerous because it contains radioactive actinides, that is, unstable waste elements produced in the power station. Here's Con Hallin from Berkeley University, California, who writes for the US publication Foreign Policy in Focus.
If you examine some of the entrance wounds on some of the tanks, on some of the T-72s that I've seen, they're classic depleted uranium ammunition wounds, relatively small holes, and then exploded outward, because when the DUA goes inside the tank, it explodes into a fireball of about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what produces all the dust and the stuff that blows all over the place and gets on people's clothes and they breathe in, etc. It really should be banned. Depleted uranium ammunition is really in the category of poison gas or dum-dum bullets. It's the kind of weapon that really should come under the Geneva Conventions, because not only is it radioactive, that is, not only can you breathe it in and therefore it produces bone marrow changes and chromosomal changes and that kind of thing, uranium is an extremely toxic metal. Uranium DUA rounds go very deep into the ground because they're so heavy. They there get into, according to the World Health Organization, they get into the water tables. And so people are drinking this stuff. It destroys kidneys. It destroys livers. It's just very dangerous stuff. And the United States also has a tremendous pile of depleted uranium because they have a very large nuclear industry. Now, what do you do with this stuff? Well, one of the things you can do is you turn it into these cannon shells, 25 millimeter, 30 millimeter, and tank shells. And they're very effective, and we trade them. Most of our NATO allies use them. Italy does not. Germany does not. Belgium is the only country in the world that's officially banned it. But we've been peddling this stuff, and we're not only peddling it, we're going to expand it. We're going to start moving it now to the use by heavy machine guns and even submachine guns. So we're going to find depleted uranium just saturating battlefields in the future. It's just a very, very bad idea. If we're pushing, for instance, a nuclear non-proliferation agreement, and we're presently have these sanctions against Iran, we have sanctions against North Korea, and at the same time that we're using nuclear materials in warfare, you know, I think most people in the world look at that and they see hypocrisy. An effective weapon that you have to step away from because the price that you pay for it in the end is simply too high. The Army knew that the stuff was dangerous. What they didn't do was they didn't tell anybody that it was dangerous. And that's still the situation today.
So that was Con Hallinan from Berkeley University in California. And he's a writer also for Foreign Policy in Focus magazine. Martin, do you think there may be repercussions from the use, as it seems clearly now from several experts have looked at the some of the damage that's been done to tanks in Libya? And it does look like the British, the French and the US are using these as tank-busting ammunition.
Well, they're standard tank-busting kit for NATO forces, so of course they are. We know that there's a huge surge in cancer and other diseases in Iraq as a result of the DU being used. It's just another depressing feature of the world we live in, which is full of war and killing.
But will there be any consequences of the use of this?
Well, of course there will. As you say, it hangs around for generations, so generations of children to come will suffer as a result of the use of these weapons.
Just developing some of the thoughts around Libya, because we've heard also this week that there were war games being planned as far back as last autumn by the French Air Force, a humanitarian war apparently against somewhere called Southland. Can you just tell us about those?
Yes. Professor Michel Chossudovsky has uncovered this at Global Research, and he's a very good researcher, and he just found it on the French Air Force website. So, on November the 2nd, 2010, more than 4 months prior to the onset of Operation Odyssey Dawn, France and the UK announced the conduct of a war game called Operation Southern Mistral 2011 against an imaginary country called Southland, living under a dictatorship, which allegedly was responsible for an attack against France's national interests, and there was going to be a UN resolution and then a no-fly zone put in by the French and British air forces. And isn't it strange that Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was supposed to start on the 25th of March. It was flagged up from November.
Actually, it was the 21st of March. 21st, it was supposed to, until the 25th. It was supposed to be a four-day exercise.
But, I mean, on the 19th, Operation Odyssey Dawn kicked in over Libya. And it is very, very suspicious that the French and British air forces had a plan to go to put a no-fly zone over Libya, or whatever it is, bomb Libya with DU or whatever, with drones, before any protests had taken place in Egypt or anywhere else. And I think this is pretty clear evidence that the NATO intervention in Libya is not about humanitarianism, it's a play for oil. And I think it's pretty disgraceful, frankly. I'm sorry for the people in Libya. The situation in Misrata is really bad, as it was in Fallujah. But what did anybody go to rescue the people of Fallujah when they were being bombed and shot at by the American Marines? No. And the people of Misrata, I think what they need in Libya now is a ceasefire and negotiations, because it's quite clear that the West has set this war up. Another war, as if we didn't have enough already.
Well, French intelligence, outrageous. Martin, is pretty good. Couldn't it be just simply that the French intelligence services had figured out that something may happen?
No, it's too pat. The scenario is exactly the same as what's happened. That, and what the government, David Cameron, has been saying, what Sarkozy has been saying, we have been responding to events. Things have just happened and we've had to do this and we've had to do that. We now know they're responding to a preconceived agenda. Now, this is extremely angering. But when we, if we think about what's been going on in the world since 2001, it's hardly surprising, is it? The Russians and the Chinese and lots of other countries around the world are getting very, very fed up with the belligerence of the Western powers. And you know what? If they carry on like this, they are going to get the world war they've been looking for, but they won't win it.
Well, I was going to come to that next, because the Russians and the Chinese are now saying that actually what's happening is a rather drastic amount of mission creep, is that much beyond just a no-fly zone, which they got in the UN resolution, and that they're now starting to kick up a fuss, both the Chinese and the Russian ambassadors to the UN.
As the Libyan foreign minister said quite reasonably last week, if you keep telling the Libyan rebels that if they fight on they will get full support from you, they're not going to negotiate with us. And the Western powers have already made it absolutely clear that nothing short of Gaddafi's overthrow will do. The problem for them is that whether they like it or not, Gaddafi has enough sinews of war, people to support him to carry on fighting. And you simply can't make him go away, and you're going to have to deal with him. You may be able to negotiate for him to leave, but you can't get away with not negotiating with him. Or you could try. I mean, I think if we do end up occupying Libya, you will find that we'll turn into a guerrilla war, as it did in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're not clear. I mean, I wouldn't try to second-guess what the political opinions of the Libyan people are. But I think if you're interested in humanitarianism, what you call for is a ceasefire. That's what we were calling for in Bosnia all the way. Ceasefire, ceasefire, ceasefire. Stop shooting. Let's talk about it. That's what you do in war zones, not say, hey, we're going to arm one side and fight to the finish. That's just basically warmongering.
But this war game that you talked about earlier,
Mistral 2011, yeah.
It wasn't even set in Libya, was it? It was set in the south of France.
Well, yes, but the south of France, called Southland, the implication, if you move the Southland south, it comes to Libya. Yeah, that's the whole point. And the fact that it was the British and French air forces in collaboration, which is exactly what we've seen happening. I think that some of the what was happened is
it was even under a UN resolution.
Even under a UN resolution, that was all part of it. And that UN resolution looks as if it'd been drawn up well in advance. Okay,
so there must have been some people in the French military who felt a bit of déjà vu here.
Oh yes, déjà vu, like the exercises going on at the tube stations on July the 7th, exactly the same places where the bombs went off. Yes, indeed, it's all just coincidence.
There were quite a lot of exercises on September the 11th as well, weren't there?
There were able danger, all the rest of it. Now, what we're dealing with here, as I think what's happened in Libya, is you have a genuine uprising by ordinary people who want to change things, but it pretty quickly turned into a battle. We know that the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya have worked with British intelligence for years. They were contracted to kill Gaddafi by MI6, according to Annie Machon, who worked for MI5. Basically, I don't trust the West to do these things right. I don't believe it when Sarkozy and Cameron claim to be humanitarians. I just don't believe it. And I think what needs to happen in Misrata is a ceasefire. Incidentally, I read in earlier on the internet, and then people pointed this out, it's quite clear, Gaddafi has recaptured several towns. He hasn't massacred the inhabitants of those towns he's recaptured. He's fighting the rebels. Yeah, just as we fought the IRA and we're fighting the Taliban. If, you know, that's war. Gaddafi is not just going to surrender his state to outside forces or internal forces who are using weapons on him. If it's fighting, it's fighting. And look, are they going to win, the West, in this case? I suspect not. They're not going to win in Iraq, they're not going to win in Afghanistan, and they're not going to win in Libya either. But I tell you who is winning. The military-industrial complex is making a packet. Every drone that's fired is money going ching-ching to some people.
Well, in British aerospace is part of which, is, of course, is based here in Bristol.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, we're arming the Saudis from Bristol up here. Now, if I was a Saudi patriot who wanted a democracy in my country, I might conclude that people up at Filton who are getting a nice living out of selling weaponry to my government, they're my enemies. Perhaps what we need at Filton is a little car bomb, just to remind you that war is war, and you are making weapons, chaps, and you're giving those weapons to the Saudis, the people who break testicles and electrocute and flog. They are, you're saying to young Saudis, we, the British people, are your enemies, but we want to go and have a nice cup of tea. We are going to get a hell of a shock if we carry on down this road. It's about time Britain woke up and realised what road we're on. We're on a collision course with the rest of the world. We are not regarded as the good guys in the majority of the planet. And if we carry on with this belligerent attitude, we will get what we deserve.
Right, Martin, thank you very much. Now, a Good Friday situation report from the Holy Land. Moving east slightly from Libya, on tensions being stoked up by the religious fanatics of 2011, from the Haifa-born son of a 1940s civil servant in British-controlled Palestine.
Hello, I'm Peter Riley. I was actually born in Haifa in Palestine before it became Israel. Our family went on holiday but couldn't return. The Irgun, the Jewish terrorist group, attacked Haifa in 1948. My mother's brothers and sisters and families fled to Lebanon. They took with their keys and their property deeds but weren't able to return. But actually that's the story of the way Israel was born. It's born on terrorism. My father was extremely well paid as a senior civil servant there, and the job opportunities weren't the same in England. I mean, we had a very good lifestyle, and when we came to England, we had pretty hard times. No, he had no intention of leaving. In fact, my mother wanted to go back, but she could have only gone back to Lebanon, and she was really homesick. She often talked about it and often cried. My father was an administrator in the Ministry of Food. He worked for the British. He was a civil servant. My mother was a Palestinian of Lebanese descent. She was brought up in Palestine. And she told me many of the stories that we heard saw on the recent Channel 4 documentary called The Promise, a four-part documentary. I could relate that quite well, particularly Diyasim, which happened in April when the Irgun attacked the village in the dead of night and slaughtered three-quarters of the population. This is what led to the fleeing of Palestinians all over from a number of villages. About three-quarters of a million fled because they feared being massacred. They were unarmed. And in the TV programme, The Promise, when the Jewish Irgun were asked, why are you turning against the British? Because they saved you from the Nazis. And their answer was, because they're in the way. And we were in the way because in the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when we promised a home for the Jews, in the same sentence, we promised to protect the rights of the non-Jewish population. In doing so, we obviously had to limit the amount of immigration, but this wasn't in the Jewish plan. They wanted all for themselves, as they do now. It's pretty obvious.
How did the Irgun, who were the Jewish terrorists of their day, how did they actually manage to make so many people get on the move?
Well, just terrorism, terrorising them. Of course, they terrorised the British. They blew up the King David Hotel. They assassinated a number of British people. My mother said they used to set booby traps on the roads to blow up the jeeps. They put bombs in the marketplaces, Arab marketplaces. This was particularly to try and get the Jews to boycott Arab marketplaces. But they terrorised. The reason why the British handed it over to the United Nations was because they couldn't cope with the terrorism against them. So they left it to the United Nations to sort out the problem. And you probably know that United Nations decided to partition Palestine. But on the map, they gave the majority of the land to a minority of the people. The Jews were still a minority, only about 33% of the population. They only owned about 6% of the land. And yet they were given nearly 60% of the land.
Some of those people must have moved voluntarily. You can't get three quarters of a million people just to leave their homes.
Why would they leave voluntarily? They left because they were feared massacres. There was a massacre in Diyasim. There were a number of massacres. Now, the best source of this is from Milan Pape, who was a professor of history at Haifa University. He's an Israeli. He's a Jew. His most recent book is called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He looked at the IDF archives in Hebrew, and he saw the Dalit plan was a plan from the word go to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, and he claims it's still their policy now. They may not be massacring them in quite the same way, but the pressure on their lives, the closures, all the pressure on the Palestinians is really to drive them out.
What was this Dalit plan you mentioned there?
The D plan, a Dalit plan, is a plan to ethnically cleanse Palestine from the non-Jewish population.
Well, you say is, but actually it's a historic thing.
Yes, but the plan is continuing. According to Alain Pape, the whole of Israeli policy is to intimidate the Palestinians, make life so difficult for them that they leave. For example, in Bethlehem, which had a very sizable Christian population, most of them were in businesses selling tourism. Bethlehem's got a wall surrounding all sides with one entrance. The entrance is controlled by the Israelis. Tourists are bussed in on Israeli buses to the tourist areas and driven straight out into Israeli shops. They can't make a living, so they have to leave, and they are leaving. They're not leaving because of Arabs or Muslims or anything. They've got on very well with Muslims. In fact, one of my colleagues went there 2 years ago and she said, is there an issue between Muslims and Christians? And they say, no, it's not an issue. We don't even ask what they are. They all got on well together. In fact, my mother told me when she was a child, the indigenous Jews there resented the immigration of European Jews because they set them against their Arab friends and neighbours on the grounds that if you're not with us, you're against us. And they didn't like that. It's a different culture. They resented the European Jewish culture.
To a certain extent, the ethnic cleansing, as you call it, is born of a kind of religious fundamentalism, actually quite a dangerous religious idea. They're on some sort of mission from God to ethnically cleanse. I mean, that sounds a bit of a strange idea, but do you think there's any credence to it?
There's a lot in it today, but it wasn't originally. Zionism started in the 1890s, and it was Herzl from Austria, an Austrian Jew, who was a secular Jew. He was an atheist. Zionism was born of a time when colonization was fashionable. There was a scramble for Africa. Every European country wanted a slice of Africa. They disregarded the rights of the indigenous population. They took the land and sold it amongst themselves. And that's exactly what the Jews were doing in Palestine. They didn't regard the people as humans. They didn't think they should have any rights at all.
Was this the case before the end of the Second World War and before the Irgun and the Stern Gang and people like this?
Yes. I mean, Zionism started, as I say, in the 1890s. There were pogroms in Russia. We all know how much the Jews did suffer, and I think that's absolutely horrific. But many of the Russian Jews came to Palestine even before 1900. They were first welcomed, according to General Glubb, who wrote his book on the history of Palestine after World War I. He said the Palestinians welcomed the Jews as blood brothers. It was only after the Zionist conference in The Hague in 1922 when they saw the thin edge of the wedge, because the Jews had said they wanted land for Jews as England is for Englishmen and America is for Americans. That's when the problem started.
Don't you think there's a bit of a problem here, though, that we're talking about the Jews, and yet there are very, very different types of people who are all of Jewish descent?
Of course. I mean, I'm not a racist. Perhaps that some of the Jews themselves are racist, particularly the Shabud Lapovitch. We often hear of quotes from the Quran, and we quote it from Hamas in their charter to see what extremists the Muslims are, but we never read about how extreme some of these Jewish religious people are, fanatics are. I would agree, if going back to the first part, most of the settlers are in fact religious fanatics. They're very, very extreme. They're racist, they're bigoted, and Shabud Lapovitch actually teach that the Jewish soul is divine, other souls are merely human or animal, and therefore Jews are superior to non-Jews, and nobody can steal land in Palestine from Jews because God gave it to the Jewish people. If that isn't racism, I don't know what is.
What is this group? Because I've not heard of them before.
Well, I'm not surprised, although they've got a budget of $22.2 billion for their international education centres. They've got at least 35 centres in Britain, about 12 universities in Britain. They're represented in every city in Europe, in every country in the world, every state of the United States. In the United States, they shake hands with political leaders. Their advice is sought by political leaders. Yet their ideology is extremely racist and supremacist.
So what is this organisation again, and what evidence have you that they actually think that they are somehow godlike?
You just read their own websites. It is a Hasidic Orthodox Jewish group. I did do some research recently, and one website claimed that they were a cult rather than a religion. It's spelled C-H-A-B-A-D, Shabud Lapovitch, L-U-B-A-V-I-T-C-H. Nahida Yassin, who was herself a Palestinian refugee, her family was made a refugee in Jerusalem in 1948 and then in 1967. She's been doing a lot of research on it, and she's got a lot of information on a blog site called Uprooted Palestinians. You can read for yourself all the sources. She's quite a good scholar, and she hasn't said anything except from sources from Shabud itself.
Now, I'm surprised that we've not heard of this group. Why haven't we heard of it? Especially if you say, as you say, it's in different towns, universities, large parts of the Western world.
Where it is heard of, they say they do good. No doubt they do some good for the Jewish people. But what's not ever exposed is their ideology towards non-Jews. They would keep that to themselves. It's only in the Jewish press, in the Israeli press, and in their own websites where they're communicating with each other do they show their teachings. There are a number of rabbis who've come up with extreme things, such as the Palestinians should all die, they should kill the Palestinians, it doesn't matter if you kill Palestinian women and children. They take a lot of their material from the Old Testament. I mean, we say the Quran's pretty bad, but the Old Testament, I mean, one of them has said that the Palestinians are the modern-day Malachites. You'd know from the Bible, I think it was in Saul, God instructed the Jewish people to annihilate them. And there are more than one of these rabbis who've said today's Amalekites are the Palestinians. And in fact, I think one of the members of the Knesset has said that the Iranians are as well.
So, how do they justify this? Because it seems like they're almost dehumanizing people.
Because they're God's chosen people. God gave them a divine soul. Some of them say we are divine. Others are merely human. They actually say other people are there to serve Jews. I know that sounds terrible. And if I went to say this about Jews were there to serve the German people, this would be incredibly racist. And it's equally racist to say that non-Jews should be serving Jews. Obviously, they don't make this widespread, but you can see for yourself. But that's a hidden agenda. That's why they're getting away with the atrocities that they commit in Palestine and in Gaza.
Now, I'm sure we're all familiar with Islamists and Islamic extremists. Do you think that there's any kind of comparison between the two?
Well, I think these are worse. Actually, there's a great deal of exaggeration about the Islamists. The Islamists have actually stated, Hamas, they say they're not against Jews per se, they're against a Jewish state of Israel, i.e. a state which discriminates against non-Jews. I mean, you can't have a Jewish state and a democratic state at the same time. A lot of the Jewish academics state this. There are at least 20 laws which discriminate against non-Jews. But Hamas has said if they had a united Palestine, whether it's called Israel, Palestine or whatever, the Jews would be protected. And indeed, Jews found shelter in Muslim countries, of course, when they were being persecuted by the Christians. And that's historically accurate. It isn't against Jews per se. It's against a Jewish state of Israel which discriminates against non-Jews. For example, in 1948, 6% of the land in Israel was owned by Jews. Today, 96% is owned because land has not been redeemed until it's in the hands of the Jews. And non-Jews can't buy land. This is one of the 20 laws which discriminate against non-Jews.
Is there any kind of limit to the amount of land that this group claims the Bible has given them?
The extreme group talks about Greater Israel, which goes from the Nile to the Euphrates, and it's significant that Israel will not define its borders. When I was a child, and until quite recently, we all believed that the poor little Israelis were going to be thrown in the sea by the Arabs. But from an Arab perspective, they could just see the Jewish state was going to expand and expand and expand until they've got what they want from the Nile to the Euphrates. And that's the reality. I'm quite convinced that most of the wars in the Middle East are really in Israel's interest.
Where do you think this is all heading now? Because quite a lot of the tension is focused around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the site of the original Jewish temple in Jerusalem, which is also now a very sacred site to the Muslims, and who have got their mosque on the same site. Looking at that, that could be the focus for tension, but how do you see things going?
Well, one of the rabbis of Shabud Lubavitch has stated, if you tear down all their mosques and their cultural centres, etc., this will be one step to solving the problem, to make the state of Israel a purely Jewish state. I don't think they want peace. It's pretty obvious now. We've seen the revelations of the documents and the WikiLeaks that they've never wanted peace. One of the Jewish academics said they've had 28 opportunities for peace, but that they don't want peace because they want a greater Jewish state where the non-Jews either serve the Jews or leave or die. So I'm not very optimistic, particularly because of the great power they have in the United States. What people don't realise is they interview every candidate for either the Senate or Congress, APAC, America, Israel Public Affairs Committee, ask them questions about Israel, Palestine, etc. If they give the right answers, in inverted commas, they get loads of cash. If they give the wrong answers, the money is used to help the opposition or even in advertising campaigns against them. Everyone in the United States government has got to be a member of APAC. And if you look at their own websites and their annual conferences, you'll see politician after politician, leader after leader saying, we love Israel, Israel's our ally, we'll always support Israel no matter what. And that's indeed what they have been doing. They vetoed so many United Nations resolutions criticizing Israel. For example, in Gaza, there was no attempt to actually even ask for a ceasefire, let alone have a no-fly zone. And Israelis have been able to get away with murder, literally.
You mentioning the United States, but hang on a minute. It's actually Britain where the Balfour Declaration was, and surely it's the fault of Britain who handed this land over and was the
crucible for the whole Zionist movement.
Yes, you're right, but I've got a book called Palestine Papers, 1917 to 1922. They're just documents and letters between Weissman and Samuels and Balfour, etc., Lloyd George. And the reason the Balfour Declaration was signed, because Weissman promised that if we signed this declaration, they could guarantee they would bring Americans into the First World War. I fully appreciate how much influence they have today, but I didn't realize they had so much influence then. And therefore, we signed the declaration in order to get the support of the Zionists to bring America into the war. But it wasn't our country to give them. What a cheek.
We also have conservative friends of Israel, Labour friends of Israel, and groups like this here in our parliament.
Yeah, and I do not understand how anyone can be a friend of a state of Israel, considering its policies has got the most right-wing extreme government you can think of. It seems to me in Israel there's right-wing, and very, very, very right-wing, absolutely racist regime. How people can be friends of Israel and a member of one of our democratic parties, I just don't understand. All I can tell you is this. Rosie Cooper, MP, from West Lancs, was written to by the West Lancs Peace and Justice Group about issues on Palestine and got a reply from the Foreign Office and sent it with her compliments. And our members went to see her to say, look, we were asking your opinions, we wanted your views on this. And she admitted she didn't know very much about it, though she was a friend of Israel. She said as soon as she was elected, she was whisked off to Israel on a educational, in inverted commas, tour, all expenses paid by the Friends of Israel, and signed up. And since then, she just receives information from the Friends of Israel, which is one-sided perspective of what's going on. She didn't know what was going on. Now, although she still remains a Friends of Israel, she is a very good MP. She's one of the few that is quite genuine. And she's been investigating it, and she's actually been speaking, asking questions on behalf of the Palestinians in Parliament. So, to answer your question, the MPs are, I wouldn't say got at, they are encouraged to join and given inducements to do so.
Whereabouts can people go on the internet to find out what their views of their MPs are on Israel-Palestine, and have you got any other websites you'd like to recommend?
It's very difficult to find whether an MP is a friend of Israel or friend of Palestine or whatever. You can certainly see on the Friends of Israel website or the Friends of Palestine website, or whether Labour, Conservative or whatever, the key members, the committee members. But it's very difficult to find out who is and who isn't. One ought to just write to the MP and ask if there's a problem in being a Friends of Israel and being a member of a democracy. They claim that Israel, of course, is the only democracy in the Middle East, but of course it's not, because it doesn't represent the views of 20% of the population. Hamas, of course, was elected democratically, but they don't recognise that. But the websites I recommend, for those absolute beginners, ifamericansknew.org. It's an American website, and it's got loads of information and lots of videos you can look at. I personally like uprootedpalestinians.blog.com. But that is a bit heavier going. They're quite detailed articles. If they want to campaign and get involved, there's the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, PSC. There's Palestine Monitor. There's Electronic Intifada, which is very good for news. Press TV is excellent.
But your favourite one?
Uprooted Palestinians. It's a blog by eminent writers, including Gilad Asmos, I think, who is Jewish Israeli, who is very much an anti-Zionist. There are, of course, a number of anti-Zionist Jews. There are Jewish Voices for Peace. Again, they've got their own website. There's the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. They've got their own website. And there's the Israeli Association of Civil Rights. And if you want to know about discrimination in Israel, that's one of them to look at.
Well, that was Palestinian-born son of a British mandate civil servant. His name's Peter Riley, speaking to me last week. The website of the fundamentalist Hasidic Orthodox Jewish sect, that's Shabad Lubavitch, he was talking about there, can be found at shabad.org. That's shabad.org and shabad.org.uk, amongst other sites. Now, joining me is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers still, again. Martin, the Israelis don't want peace. That's the accusation he's making there.
Well, they don't want peace unless it's on their terms, which means that you want war, because basically if you're not prepared to compromise, you have to fight, don't you?
And is it actually, do you think there's any credibility to what he's saying about it actually being almost an apartheid state, which is designed for Jewish people and not Arabs?
Well, they openly say that it is, so, you know, we should take them in their word, shouldn't we?
And what about this? Obviously there are quite a few Jewish people who are actually supporting the Palestinian cause in one way or another. Gilad Atzmon is one of them.
Yes, he's a jazz musician based in Britain. He's Jewish and he's very hostile to Israeli government policy, as many Jews around the world are, and many people inside Israel. One really fantastic Israeli voice for reason is Uri Avenry, who was originally a right-wing Jewish nationalist, a terrorist actually, who kills many British soldiers. But he's very, very clear that if his own country is not prepared to make peace with the Palestinians, they deserve, you know, to fight and to lose. And he, because he's a traitor from the right wing in Israel, he's hated by the right wing, bitterly hated, but he's actually a very, very humane man, and if people can find his stuff on the internet, he's one of the voices of reason in Israel.
The idea of a rabbi encouraging people to smash down the Al-Aqsa Mosque and things like this is a little bit worrying. Why don't we hear about this so much as the Muslim extremists?
Because we're being bombarded with war propaganda by governments, aren't we? It's all about poor little Belgium and the Hun raping Belgian nuns, isn't it? When we look back at the war propaganda that people were subjected to in previous wars, we can always see how silly it is. But when we're being bombarded with it by our own media while it's happening, we all lose our marbles and try and go along with it all. We are riding towards a Middle East war, which could turn into a world war. People really need to face up to this. As the dollar collapses, as the world economy tanks out, we could be going to World War III. And what we really need to do is take a step back and take a deep breath. But that's not what's happening, is it?
If there is a World War III focused around the Middle East, what do you think are going to be the main protagonists?
Well, obviously, they're lining Iran up to be attacked. I mean, that's quite clear. But the Iranians were going to give them some very nasty surprises, I suspect.
Martin Summers, Old Labour, Oxford Economist, thank you very much. So, also, that's all for this week. And coming up, the Sky News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was Labour MP for Bristol East and Shadow Treasury Minister Kerry McCarthy. And, of course, to all who you just heard, Old Labour, Oxford Economist Martin Summers there. Next week, the businessman and recently uncharacteristically media-shy chairman of University Bristol Hospital Trust's John Savage comes under the spotlight in our final show before the AV referendum and local elections. We'll also be dishing the dirt on some local councillors who have refused to come on this show. So that's all for this week. Have a very lovely and happy Easter holiday. The podcasts for this show are at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for listening. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody